Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Gallen. Joining me in studio right now is victims' rights advocate Joan Roberts. We're going to be talking about false memories and how they are sometimes used to falsely convict or accuse somebody for sexual abuse. Joan is a student at Northern Michigan University, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And there's a seminar we're going to be talking about that people who want to learn more about this can partake in locally, though it's going to be taking place at Northern. People locally can be able to view it through as a webinar. We'll give you the details on that coming up. First, Joan, give us a little bit of information about yourself and you know, what qualifies you as a victims' rights advocate.
Well, I have been researching the topic of repressed memory therapy and manufacturing memories is what that really is. The repressed memory idea is actually a misnomer because a therapist or child protection services, they manufacture memories in a child or in the case of therapy in a teen or an adult. So I started researching this topic, and I joined the National Center for Reason and Justice. That's an organization that helps people who have been falsely accused.
Okay. What is victimology?
Well, victimology is a study of how becoming a victim affects your life. So if you're a victim of a robbery or a sexual assault, how does that affect you long term, and what type of restitution can you expect, and just what your life, because your life is going to be changed when you become a victim.
Okay. And we can already kind of see a difference there. If you are a victim of a robbery or something, you're actually a victim of somebody's actual crime against you. And what we're kind of talking to, or what's going to be an emphasis at this webinar on repressed memory therapy and how it affects those that are victims of, you know, those false memories being used to convict them or accuse them of sexual abuse. Well, that's a crime that didn't happen. You know, so you're a victim of a crime that, you know, that didn't happen, or you're accused of the perpetrator of that crime, rather. Now,
yeah, it's a non-crime. It's just kind of a strange, bizarre thing. But correct. There's two victims. I divide this in my presentation. I divide this between victims A and victim B. Victim A being the patient of the therapist, they are also victimized because their life changes. They didn't know that they had any memories until these memories are manufactured. And then you have victim B, they're the people that are accused. So they're accused victim of the victim, and it grows.
Okay, let's get the details of the webinar so that people will know, and we'll come back to it before the end of the program. What's going on at Northern?
Well, the Criminal Justice Department has sponsored this. It's part of my directed study. And the seminar will be for an hour and a half on Tuesday, April 17th, at the Learning Resource Center, Room 109.
Okay. So if you're local in your Marquette, in the Marquette area that day, you can attend it physically?
That's correct. Okay. You can physically attend.
Okay. And now for those that are not going to be in Marquette, is it available online?
Yes, it is. You can sign into Zoom, and when you go to Zoom, you can participate in the webinar itself, and it will be recorded. So if someone cannot come in on Tuesday night, they can access it through the Northern Michigan University webpage.
Okay, and we did post some information on this on KeyWinnerReport.com. If you want to be able to, if you want to log into that, you can follow a link, and that will take you right to the webinar and more information. You have a guest speaker for this.
Yes, I do. Mark Pendergrass is from Vermont. He's an independent scholar. He's the author of a number of books, including Memory Warp, which is an updated version of his original Victims of Memory that was written during the 90s. And the book Memory Warp is at Michigan Tech University in their library, and it's also at Northern. But Mark is going to speak for 30 minutes of the 1.5-hour presentation that I give.
And you know what topics he'll be covering?
Yes, he is going to cover the research that he himself did on recovered memory therapy and how different books were used to promote this idea during the 80s and 90s. He will expound on that and use some of the information that he, of course, has gathered all over these years.
Now, I think that's kind of an important fact that you bring up there, that the repressed memory therapy was something that was popularized back in the 80s when it became very popular for people to use this as a therapy. And over the years, it was soundly debunked as an effective way of treating people. And I'm going to let you kind of talk about that, since you're the expert, on what that therapy is and also its dangers.
Well, it is very dangerous, and one of the professors at Northern Michigan University renamed it manufactured memories, and I like that a lot better because what happened during that era where it was so popular, though it still occurs now as far as the therapy for recovered memory therapy or repressed memory therapy, is that there are no real memories. These are manufactured, and by calling that originally repressed or false memories, it gave validity to the term. So then it created a controversial issue where people were arguing and saying, well, what if the memories are real? And that wasn't the idea. The truth is the memories are manufactured, and how it came about was that a person would go to therapy because they were depressed or they had an eating disorder or they broke up with their boyfriend, whatever it was. I even had a woman tell me that she went into the doctor to talk about her weight gain, and the doctor right away said, well, did you know that this is a symptom of repressed memory therapy? That means that you could have been sexually abused when you were a child. And then the therapist or the doctor will say, do you think you've ever been sexually abused?
Okay. Well, how does that lead to, I think I have, when they haven't?
Well, they don't say, I think I have. They will say, I don't think I have. I don't remember. And then the therapist will say, I can help you bring up memories. And I believe this is a problem that you might have. And we can explore this. And the therapist will suggest, which is something they are not supposed to do. They are supposed to deal with the patient for how they've come in. And the patient is supposed to say what's wrong with them.
Is it a form of hypnotism? I mean, how are these memories supposedly recovered?
Well, in the onset of this, hypnotism was really popular, and I believe it still goes on today. But the point that is made in a lot of these documentaries that I have seen and the books that I've read is that the patient already is vulnerable. So they're somewhat intimidated by a person that's sitting across from them that says, I'm the expert. I know that memories can be repressed, and I can help you bring those memories up. And they keep talking to them, and they keep suggesting, you need to explore this. Could this have happened to you? And they advise the patient to go home and think about, could this have happened? Sometimes they go home and they read books on incest. And what really triggers it, if you read books on any topic, you're likely to dream about that night or during the course of the week. And these patients will come back and they'll say, I had this horrible nightmare that my grandfather, my mother, somebody raped me or did something inappropriate to me. And at that point, they're pretty much sucked in because the therapist will say, that wasn't a dream, that was a flashback. And that really happened to you, and I can help you bring up more memories.
Well, what would be the motivation behind somebody that's treating a patient to introduce this?
I believe in the early years, as Dr. Simpson points out in his book, Second Thoughts, I believe in the early years that they really thought they were helping people bring these memories forward. But as time went on, it became quite lucrative. And then the idea of repressed memories grew and grew, and it became lucrative through the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. And if you can label someone with post-traumatic stress disorder, then this is covered by state funding, or they can get Social Security. Insurance will cover it. What the insurance companies and Social Security don't understand is what's behind that post-traumatic stress disorder. It's not that the patient actually went there with post-traumatic stress. This post-traumatic stress is actually created through the fears and the worries that these patients have now that they are supposed to believe they had memories being unpacked, as one therapist called it. And now this is their new life, and they have to start trying to deal with, did my father really do this to me? Did somebody else do this to me? It doesn't matter who it is, but did this really happen to me? And a lot of patients will say, oh, this is the answer to all my problems. I've had these problems during my life, and I didn't know what they were.
How would somebody differentiate between those that maybe actually did suffer something from this, something that they've blocked or repressed, as opposed to somebody who's manufacturing them?
Well, for starters, you wouldn't have someone have to coerce you or accuse you of being in denial or suggest. You would walk into the therapist's office and you would say, I think I remember I had this event in my life and I think something happened to me. And I'm glad you brought that question up, because when the Nassar case came forward, I was watching that quite closely. And I believe there were 156 girls who came forward. And those girls' ages, if I remember correctly, dated were back to when they were 12 years old. And during those hearings, I never heard one girl say, I had to go to a therapist to have her help me uncover memories. Those girls remembered the horrific things that happened to them at the hands of Nassar. And they came forward and they said, this happened to me. And they were able to be very specific about when it happened in his office. They remembered. They didn't have to have somebody say, I need you to help me recover my memories.
All right, so let's go. We're still back when this was a popular growing in popularity way of treating people. What was the effect on those that were accused?
Well, they became the victims of the accuser. So we have a victim of the victim. That's where we're sitting, is we have the first victim and then we have the secondary victim. Sometimes they were not just accused, but often they were convicted. Criminal charges were brought against them.
With no other evidence other than the testimony.
That's correct. And in Michigan, and I don't know what other states, I know in Wisconsin and in Michigan, if you're accused of a criminal sexual conduct, which is referred to as a CSC, if you're accused of that, there is no evidence necessary to get a conviction.
Who were being targeted? Families? Parents?
Often it was a father. If the father was deceased, it could be a brother. Sometimes it was a mother. It could be anybody, but it was usually a family member, and it was often the father.
Even if a conviction doesn't result because of it, the other damages to the person's livelihood, their life, their family would come out of this.
Well, it's extensive. Even if they're not charged, you still have the same victimization problems because your whole life is turned upside down. This causes a lot of divorces where the women stand beside their husband and they know that this never happened. Then they have to work through all these problems. They have to try to figure out how to get their son or daughter away from this type of therapy. And they're paraded across the TV screen, or the neighbors find out about it and they're condemned. Your life is just not the same.
Yeah, or the spouse sticks with the child, the victim, the original victim. And, you know, how do you convince somebody who doesn't know? We can never really know another individual, you know, so somebody that's accused, even somebody that they're married to, would have, you know, they have to make a choice whether to believe the accusations that are coming from the person in therapy or to believe the person denying it. And it's got to put everybody in a tough situation.
Well, it does. And I think it would be very helpful if there were consent forms. Would be a solution to part of the problem. If in mental health, there are no mandated consent forms. So if there were consent forms where the patient had to go in and say, I'm here because I have an eating disorder, rather than 2 months later, they say, oh, now I have these memories. I think that's one thing that families should look at, is where did this get started?
Hmm. Well, we're certainly, and right now, it comes to mind, like the Me Too movement and stuff. You know, we want to believe the victims when they say that they've been a victim. And that's our, you know, and right, really kind of rightfully so, our first reaction is to, you know, believe and to investigate and to, you know, not to minimalize, you know, what somebody says they've gone through. But in cases that you're talking about, the person who's the victim or believes that they were a victim, they don't even know themselves. They've been convinced themselves that something has happened to them that hasn't happened.
Yes, that's true. They become very convinced, depending on how forceful the therapy is, how much hypnotism is involved.
Hmm. So how did it start to get debunked when other people began to review this therapy and time went on a little bit?
Well, in 1992, the False Memory Syndrome Foundation was formed. all the parents started finding each other. These falsely accused parents started finding each other. And most of these were upper middle class professional people. A lot of them were psychologists or lawyers themselves. And they formed this organization, the False Memory Syndrome Foundation. And they started getting lots and lots of calls from other parents. And it was determined that the best way to go about this was to sue the therapist for malpractice. Because this is negligent, it's not, it wasn't recognized, and it wasn't a regulated form of therapy.
But that's a problem in itself, the parents trying to sue a third party.
Yes, it is. There are now about 8 states where you can sue the therapist for the damage that is done to you.
Is the therapy regulated now? Is it still considered legal? Is it still practiced?
There just isn't enough regulation. I spoke to someone at the state licensing board, and they informed me that there were a lot of things that weren't regulated, and this is one of those. And when I talked to other therapists who weren't sure if this was a valid therapy or not, they just would say, well, I don't use it. I don't think it's right. But the American Psychological Association has not taken the bull by the horn and said, we're going to only have therapy that we know is scientifically based. And this is not considered scientifically based. It was 1995 that the APA put out a warning about recovered memory therapy. And I believe they were the ones who called it junk science. But they did not say you can't use it.
Now, I believe in therapy. I believe in, you know, it's the positive effects. I think that there's a tremendous amount of benefits that can come from, you know, working through things with a therapist. But if you're shopping for a therapist, if you're entering therapy, how do you determine if the person who's going to be treating you would use this technique? I doubt they'd come out right out and say, oh, by the way, I think I can find some memories you don't have.
Well, I want to say first that I believe that we do need the mental health therapist, and I think the Upper Peninsula has a lot of really good therapists, and I don't think there are that many up here who support this idea, but they are here. And to find a good therapist, I think you would do a little bit of background of where they went to school and what kind of training they have, and then ask outright, have you ever dabbled in recovered memory therapy? And if they are really opposed to it, they will definitely want to let you know, because they don't want to be tainted in their business with this junk science.
So now we're some 25 years or so since this was made popular, as we were referring back into the 80s. Is it considered still a widespread issue? You said that many people, you know, therapists are not practicing this, but it's also not very regulated. Are there still victims of this?
There are still victims. Through the National Center of Reason and Justice is how I found out there were so many more. And the pattern is always the same. That's something that's real obvious. I know in the book Lost Daughters, which is written by the editor in Chicago, Rainer Van Til, he wrote about his daughter having gone off to school, went to college, and the psychology teacher was talking about you could have repressed memories. And the girl went to a therapist, and she just came to believe this idea, and she falsely accused her dad. And the mother immediately threw him out of the house. But 6 months later, she came to him and she said, I guess you were right. This must have never happened, because now she's accused me. So the problems just go on and on. But you have to really be careful and choose a therapist that doesn't believe in this and practices valid therapy.
It sounds like there was a progression in the case that you just mentioned, where it was originally it was one person being accused and then another person being accused. Does the memories, these manufactured memories, begin as something with very little information and then just over time becomes blown into something, maybe even getting to absurd degrees at some point?
Well, that is correct. The longer the person is in therapy, the worse everything becomes. It usually starts out with inappropriate touching, and then as they read more incest survivor books or they join group counseling with other supposed incest survivors, and there are incest survivors there, but we don't know how many are in that group are real incest survivors. But once they get into the group therapy, there are two problems that arise. That becomes almost like a gang mentality. The other women want the support of all the other women. And they also vie for the attention of the therapist. So they want to make a bigger and better story. So the stories do grow. And if patients, I've just read another book on this false memory syndrome, women that have come forward. If they try to get out of that group, they are really criticized by the group itself because that then becomes their support group. And the memories do get really, really absurd. I know in the Nadine Cool case, I was just reading up on that again. That was from Wisconsin. I think that was back in the 90s. And Nadine Cool sued her psychiatrist. He had convinced her that she had, I believe, 14 personalities and that she had killed babies and eaten them. It was horrible. I believe it was Tom Brokaw who did an interview with her. But what I found out when I was just reading the other day about this 14 personalities, the other problem that happens is this psychiatrist was in trouble because he actually billed for all those other personalities. So, isn't that insane? Yeah. So we have even more problems than just the victim problems. Now we have the insurance company. Are they called the victims too?
Well, yeah, that's a lot of a big workload. You've got to treat 14 different personalities. So, for recourse for those that find themselves either in the situation where they're being falsely accused, or somebody that's been treated and was convinced of memories they didn't have, where can these people go to get help? Let's first start with those that are battling. Being accused, is there any legal recourse they can have besides just the normal police?
Well, the National Center for Reasoning and Justice is really great. They're a nonprofit organization. They vet cases. There are volunteers like myself, and we take the information, and then we try to give them a list of things to do that would help them. And then if they need someone to help them find an attorney or a private investigator or an expert witness, that's what we do. We network around the United States, and we'll divide a case between two people, and we'll say, hey, this case sounds like this person, this attorney would work. And we try to get attorneys to offer to help.
I'm sure the road to recovery for somebody that whose memory has been affected, basically somebody's mind has been messed with, is a long one, to be able to come back from this. If somebody, they're seeking help, has there been help made available for them?
Well, the False Memory Syndrome Foundation is a source for those people, but the best advice is to call and find someone who does not practice recovered memory therapy or manufacturing memory therapy and see if you can find someone that can help you undo that damage. In another book that I was reading, a woman said that once she left her therapist, she was able then to go get the help that she needed and found someone to help her. But she said that core group was so hard to get away from because your security is in that support group. It's either through your therapist in that group counseling, and you're afraid to leave. So there's a lot of fear factor there for these people.
I want to again bring us back to the webinar that's coming up. So people that have been listening to this interview and they want to learn more, this is a great opportunity for them to be able to do it. Can you give us the where and when?
So it'll be at Northern Michigan University in the Learning Resource Center, and it's below the library. It's in Learning Resource Center, room 109. It's sponsored by the Criminal Justice Department, and that's on Tuesday night at 6:30 for an hour and a half on April 17th.
Okay. And the speaker, that's Mark Pendergrast?
Correct. He will come in at 6:45. He'll be Skyped in.
You'll be speaking at this as well. What will you be talking about?
After Mark speaks, I will be talking about the legal aspects of this. I'm going to be talking to two surprise guests that have been charged, and all their charges were, I'll just say dropped, but they'll tell their story about what it's like to become a victim. And then I will help explain how my criminal justice classes help me understand that mental health actually circumvents what we call criminal procedure. This idea of suggesting, coercing, intimidating, and manipulating is actually called law enforcement evidence that is not admissible in court. However, I believe that this criminal procedure rule is being circumvented through mental health, because once a patient becomes convinced, they bring evidence into the court that is suggested, coerced, manipulated, and it's an intimidation evidence, and it really shouldn't be admissible.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back. One of the things that you kind of mentioned about Mark Prendergast's book, you said that he had updated it. And so here's an author who has, committed part of his career to writing about this subject. And he, wrote the book some number of years ago and then had to update it, which I guess would show that it's something that is continuing to happen, continue to evolve, and what people need to continue to be aware about. Okay. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.